Our next topic is developing codes of practice, scientifically informed, practical, and reflective of societal expectations. We have four speakers, and I'm going to quickly introduce them, and they're going to come up, and their names are on their spots. And our first is Ryder Lee, Manager of Federal-Provincial Relations with Canadian Cattlemen's Association. Ryder has been an executive member of on the NFAC board since 2010. Welcome, you're right here. Jeff Erton, the first of our Jeffs to speak today. I think you speak a couple of times too. Jeff Erton is Manager of Stakeholder Relations for the BCSPCA and represents the Canadian Federation of Humane Societies on the NFAC board and executive. And next we have Tina Wadowski. There you are, Tina. Hi. Tina is a professor of applied animal behavior and welfare at the Department of Animal and Poultry Science and is the director of the Campbell Center for the Study of Animal Welfare at the University of Guelph. And finally, we have Fred Baker, who I've just met this afternoon. Hi, Fred. He's a sheep producer, and he's past chair of the Canadian Sheep Federation and is the sheep industry representative from NFAC. And when I asked him where he came from, he said, Mountain, Ontario. And I'm going, well, you know, for me, most mountains have a name. So your no-name mountain, I think we're going to call it Baker Mountain from now on. Welcome, and I'll get you to lead off. Ryder and others, would you then just take questions without me coming back up to the podium? Okay? Thanks very much. Over to you. Number one, you're number one.
Well, great. So I can talk and use up the whole thing. Thanks for the introduction. I won't introduce myself. I guess I'll just cut right to the chase because we've each got to take a turn here. And what I was told to talk about was about four questions. No, I don't have a PowerPoint.
I've got one. So.
Oh, okay. There we go. High-tech Jeff. But the first one was, what did I learn from the code process? And I was involved in the beef code right from the start. There was some work internally at Alberta Beef Producers and then at CCA trying to update the existing code from 91 and get it. We knew it needed to be updated long before maybe even NFAC was formed. So it predated this process, but then when we decided to go through this process, I was involved in putting the committee together and inviting people, and maybe hoodwinking might be a strong word, into getting people involved in this, and some of them are in this room. And what I learned around that was it's really important who you have around the table for drafting codes of practice. You need people who play well with others. And Allison might attest to that I did sometimes a good job on that. But you also need people who can hear others, because what came out of the process, it's a change and adaptation exercise. You have strong people, they all had opinions and experience, and the final code is probably different from what any of them would have written. So you need to be able to play well with others, but you need to be able to listen too. So I don't know how useful that skill is going, or those lessons are going to be to anybody in here that might have to go through this again. But it was really clear the who was around the table is important. Another thing I learned was there's a lot of fear about being controlled by others at the producer level. Producers are getting hit a lot of ways these days around regulation, around land use, around environment regulations, what happens with your water course, what kind of tag you need to have in your animal, and what happens if it falls out, and how big is that fine. There's different stories about SPCA, if you're in the right province, or other enforcement stories that just seem to be getting, it's not just me taking care of the animals, there's a lot of people that want to tell me how to do that, and that's got people concerned. And another thing that's not really news, but it was driven home by this process, is, man, the Canadian cattle business is a diverse industry. It's a big country of different practices. You know, we're all blessed with different kinds of environment, or whatever every ranch and farm looks like is really different depending where you are, and what's normal is not the same everywhere we are. The climate, the value chain you're in. The other thing, you know, outfits that sell to consumers are not really engaged in animal care conversations until they are. We saw that in our code of practice. We didn't have a representative from retail and food service, but then we've also seen some labels come out in the last month and a half around animal welfare marketing. So, you know, that's something that we struggle with at NFAC. We saw that on the code of practice, and hopefully we can fix that. I'm glad to see a table full over here, but I hope it's three or four or five tables down the road so that as people who sell products can make decisions, they're doing it with industry and as a part of this process rather than from the outside. Get off that soapbox. There's a lot of wonder at the producer level about why people are interested in how we care for our animals. Cattle generally come before spouses, children, family vacations, sporting events, and just about everything else. So to be questioned about whether I'm doing the right thing for my animals is an emotional thing. So this kind of change process is hard, and I get some of those questions directly and come from a ranch myself. So it's that's why some of this is so hard for people as a change exercise. You know, how we overcame the biggest challenges was the next question, and pain management was probably our biggest one, and how we overcame that, I think, is time to implement changes, science behind it, having a science-informed process, and balancing between what everybody around that table thinks would like to do. Challenge remains and research is ongoing, but the time to consult also with the ability, you know, this process needs to be able to be open and closed at the same time, I guess. The drafts need to be able to, all the people who are around the table need to be able to leave that room and talk to their groups about this and come back without it getting drug through the media and becoming a big deal that way. I gotta turn this over in a second, so I finish with what's the code offer our constituents, you know, cattle producers, and what's needed to keep commitment. This is the basis of the conversation we'll have with the people who we sell to and the people that they sell to. That's to me retail and food service. Continued communication, you know, showing that the code is positive for cattle and for their owners and the people that take care of them. And research that further shows how and when and why we do things these ways will be important to keep the commitment. Further fleshing out some of these tough to talk about areas or thing that is change. That will all depend on research, and that value of research investment, I think, will be shown by our code of practice and by the conversations that we have moving forward. These aren't things that we just picked out of the air. We didn't change for the sake of it. Most of it is grounded in practicality, science, and possibility and economics underneath all of that. I'll move your scotch for you.
Thanks. So I've got a few slides to flip through to help me sort of with just as visual cues to reflect on what our experience has been with BCSPCA and Canadian Federation of Humane Societies participating in these processes. And I think, so we've been involved in the development of all the new codes. So I think we've got five in the bank and two more close and two just started. And so it's been a great experience for me to be involved in so many processes, sitting on a couple of those committees myself and having myself being on the sidelines of some of them as well to see how those processes are functioning. And I'd certainly agree with Ryder's perspective that it's important to have the right people in the room. And I think it's also important to give credit to the industry associations who've stepped up to participate in this process and subject themselves to this scrutiny. It's totally voluntary. No one is forcing these industry associations to come up and develop a new code of practice. I think it's important for non-industry stakeholders to remind themselves of that context and to think about the last time they invited somebody in external to their business or their office to come and scrutinize how they run their business. So there's industry deserves a lot of credit there. So our organizations are animal welfare organizations. Our role is to, our mission is to improve animal welfare, to promote the humane treatment of animals, and the approach that we choose to take and that we have always chosen to take, at least since my involvement, is to work with industry and other stakeholders to do that, to sit at the table and have these conversations face-to-face. I wanted to consider a little bit about what the do these new codes, are they meeting these tests that we've set out through NFAC of being scientifically informed, practical, and reflective of societal expectations? And so I think you look at the code process, and Susie Miller spoke to this in terms of the credibility of the process. The new code process that we have has a few features in it that really bulk up the credibility over the former recommended codes of practice. And the scientific committees that prepare this scientific report, that's a big part of that. But the scientific committees, they're not making decisions, right? They're just providing conclusions. They're unbiased, independent conclusions, having reviewed all of the relevant literature on key issues. It's the code committee themselves, this group of stakeholders who have to engage in the dialogue and engage in that difficult task of coming to consensus. So yes, I think it's we can absolutely say with confidence that these codes of practice are scientifically informed. But ultimately, each code is landing in a slightly different spot based on whoever was sitting around the table and the practical realities in the industry provides the landscape for us to be able to build a code of practice with stronger or weaker requirements. Are these codes practical and reflective of societal expectations? Well, let's be honest. These things are often at odds. And this is where it's hard for us to come to consensus. When you have practices that the public would like to see, particularly members of the public who are engaged on animal welfare issues like the members of SPCAs and humane societies around the country, we may have expectations for things to be done that producers don't feel are practical or don't feel are cost-effective. And so that's why we have this diversity of people around the table to try to balance that and come to consensus. And we do our best. We put a draft out for public comment. And ultimately, that's what we hear in the public comment period. If we're way off base in terms of what's practical as requirements in the code, we're going to hear from producers. If we're way off base in terms of certain standards in the code not being progressive enough, we're going to hear about it from the public. And so how are we doing? I think if we're trying to aim for this target where the requirements in each of these codes meet all of those tests, well, it's a small target to hit on a big field. It's not easy to do. But I think this was probably in Edouard's presentation earlier that it's certainly worth doing. I think there's a parallel here in terms of the target we're trying to hit with concepts of animal welfare in terms of the way different people think about what animal welfare means to them. And this is a concept David Fraser came up with from UBC that shows that some people think about animal welfare more in terms of what the animal's actual experience is, how it's feeling. Some people think about it a little bit more in terms of the animal's function, its health. And other people think about it in terms of what's natural, what's in the natural environment for that animal to live in. Is it able to display natural behaviors? And I think if we aim for the same kind of target, then we're probably going to do our best job at meeting the needs of all of the diverse interests in this process. And so I think it's good to reflect on where we've come from. So how were we doing with the old recommended codes of practice? I don't think they ever really fulfilled. They were a good step. They were a start, getting people together and beginning to put something on paper. But when you look at where the requirements or the must-do statements were in those codes, they were really in safe territory for industry, sticking to things like meeting the basic biological needs of the animals. Do your animals have feed and water? Some requirements for healthcare, and I think that they, especially over time, decades of not being updated, they failed to keep up. So how are we doing now? Well, I think we're a lot closer, and I think this process has facilitated that. I think we're honing in on that target, and each industry sector has its own realities in terms of the production systems and the economic climate, everyone's come a long way. And even the pig industry, for instance, which doesn't have a finalized code yet, that draft code goes a long way towards addressing improvements in the subjective state of animals, how animals are feeling, and societal expectations. So really, when you look at how people have weighed in on progress, I think you can see, just using this example from the dairy code, that industry is getting credit. So BCSBCA, we of course were integrally involved in the dairy code. Well, we had a lot of good things to say about that code. But even organizations like the Canadian Coalition for Farm Animals, who are not known for heaping praise on industry, had something positive to say. And so I think that demonstrates that these codes are going a long way to address public expectations. So we're making progress, and we're honing in on that target. We're triangulating, and industry certainly deserves credit for that. And I think the next step, which NFAC has set the table for, is providing some tools that allow industry to demonstrate their compliance with the codes, because these codes of practice, if they sit on a shelf and there isn't verification that they're adhered to, then I think we might start to lose some of that credibility we've gained by undertaking this work to develop the codes. So, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. Hi, good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here today. As Susan mentioned, I'm Tina Wadowski, and I'm here as my role as a scientist on scientist committees. And I've had the pleasure and opportunity to sit on three of the scientist committees. That means I haven't been able to have an opinion, as Jeff has said, until very recently. I've sat on the Pig Scientist Code, the Poultry Meat Bird Scientist Committee, as well as the Langhen. And I'm chairing the Langhen, so this is my first opportunity to actually participate in the code development process. We've had our first meeting, and so far, so good. So mostly I'm going to be sharing with you some of my observations and experiences as being a member of multiple scientist committees. And so we've been given four questions that we're going to be answering. What have we learned from the process? And one of the things that I've learned is that Canada has developed a process to be proud of. When we share this with colleagues, animal welfare scientists around the world, and how we are the two-step phase for producing the scientist's report and then followed by the code development with the multi-stakeholder group is really one that provides balance and that we should be proud of. The process that the scientists use themselves has fairly strict guidelines. And actually, can we borrow one of your slides? Can I borrow one of your three circles, of course? We need to get a new shape going here one of these days. And I just want to explain a little bit so that you understand. Scientists, too, have biases. And depending on the scientists and what their area of expertise is, they have a different perspective on animal welfare as well. And the way that the scientist committees are made up, in and of itself, provides some balance to the process of reviewing the scientific literature. The first step that is taken in developing these scientists' reports is that priority welfare issues are identified by the CDC group, so the code development committee, as well as the scientists that are chosen. Okay, scientists are chosen from a variety of backgrounds, including animal welfare scientists who primarily specialize in behavior and so have a certain perspective, It includes veterinarians as well as animal scientists. And so with a mix of scientific expertise and perspectives, we have a mixture of perspectives just going into the scientist report. Okay. Then the priority welfare issues are listed, generally agreed upon by both the multi-stakeholder co-development committee and the scientist committee. And my experience in all three is that we came up with pretty much the same list. Everyone knows what their issues are and what we need to look to the science for. Then another part of the process, which brings a lot of balance to it, is that one of the mandates for the scientist committee is to consider the literature from all of these perspectives that Jeff showed. Okay, so we know that there are different ways to define and to look at animal welfare, and we are mandated to consider all the different types of evidence. And if you actually look through the conclusions that are in all the scientist committee reports, you will see that many of the conclusions come from different perspectives. And sometimes there are trade-offs that are involved. Okay. Once we develop this, the code, the scientist committee report is drafted. It's reviewed by the code development committee. They ensure that we have fulfilled what we are asked to do in terms of reviewing the literature. Then it goes out to peer review to other scientists in the world. Okay, so then it goes, this is the process for peer-reviewed literature. Then we have to respond to any concerns or questions or open gaps that our peer reviewers, other scientists around the world would have. Okay, so as scientists, then we draw our conclusions, but as Jeff said, we don't make any recommendations whatsoever. One of the things that... One of the things that I learned is that we know a lot. The particular code committees I'm on, particularly the Langhens, there have probably 5,000 reference papers. That is the first animal we began studying animal welfare on, and we know a lot. But you know what? There's even more that we don't know about. And so when there's questions about how to make recommendations about certain aspects of animal care, there's still a lot more work to be done. So many areas, we don't have the science or the research in order to make that those evidence-based recommendations. So what were the biggest challenges? You saw the list of all of those different codes that have scientist committees, and each of those scientist committees involves five or six scientists on the committee plus a research writer. If you do the math on that and understand how many animal welfare scientists there are in the country, it doesn't add up. Okay, there's not enough scientists, and many of us are doing double and triple duty. Okay, so there's been a huge investment from all the different stakeholders and from the scientific community in this whole process. And it's not just serving on the scientist committees for these, but also the fact that we've identified all these gaps in the literature, and there's a lot more work that needs to be done. So there is still a huge role for science. What was a bit discouraging is during this process in the last year, we've lost some of our top animal welfare scientists in the country with the AAFC cuts. And so these are scientists that are no longer available to work on the committees for developing the reports, but also that adds to a gap in where our research needs to go. So how did we overcome this? A lot of late nights, just like everyone in this room who's been involved in the code. And so we should all be very proud of the commitment that people have put into this. What does the code offer our constituents? Who are the scientist constituents, the broader community, as well as the agricultural sector, as well as the animals themselves? And I think that we've been able to bring balance by making sure that we bring literature from all of the different perspectives. We have to understand that the codes are going to be a living document, that we're going to find out more and continue to add science to make improvements, and that the job isn't going to be done when we're done, which is also a bit discouraging, but it's also something to look forward to is continuous improvement. So Finally, animal welfare is a public good. Scientists are an important part of the process, and industry has led and is supporting a lot of the research and the scientists, but we need to make sure that there's still a role for the government in supporting animal welfare science in Canada. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Ryder already commented on the importance of some of the people, of having the appropriate people around the table, so I won't even touch that. That was one of the things that I learned. But a couple of the other things that I learned is that farmers are a taciturn bunch. Generalizations are dangerous, but I'm going to use some to make my point. Farmers are a taciturn bunch. They're not given to flapping their gums if they're not complaining about weather, prices, or the fight at the hockey game last night. So they tend to be a quiet bunch. The group, however, that I affectionately call policy wonks and desk jockeys absolutely love to hear the sound of their voice, and they will get into a room and they will actually compete with each other to unpack a concept, to add to something, to drill down through something, and sometimes just say the same thing as the person before them said in slightly different language. And that all that talk can make the room to start to spin. And, you know, just like a frat boy coming home from a big party at 2 o'clock in the morning, sometimes a foot needs to be slipped out over the side of the bed to make the room stop spinning. And invariably in our code process, that foot outside the edge of the bed was a farmer asking a simple question that kind of caused everyone to stop talking about what was possible and what could be done and what might be done, and actually coalesce around a certain point. Now, a point comes to mind when we were talking about the issue of pain management and tail docking. There was a day and a half discussion about how it could be done, what should be done, all the possibilities, all the drugs that were available, all the ones that weren't available. And it swirled until someone asked about the dosage that would be required to anesthetize a tail that's on an 8-pound lamb that's the size of a small lead pencil, a golf pencil. And, then all of a sudden the calculations start, and the concept of trying to administer 0.125 of a mil into a squirming little lamb. Like, nothing is going to kickstart the cortisol level of a baby lamb like yanking him away from his mother's side, elevating him 4 feet, flipping him upside down, strapping him down like a unwilling participant at an S&M convention, and then trying to inject that little tail with a minute dose of anesthesia. And all of a sudden, reality hits, the practicality of that hits, and our friends in the desk jockey policy want group all of a sudden coalesce around a concept that will work for 90% of the production that happens in Ontario. Desk jockeys and policy wonks also love to beat every single concept to death before they can coalesce around at any point. When we were talking about euthanasia, the suggested initial wording was that euthanasia must be done without delay. That wasn't good enough. We had to parse for a day and a half, or not quite a day and a half, what the difference was between immediate, without delay, and as soon as possible. As soon as possible might allow a farmer to go out and cut a field of hay because it might rain tomorrow before he euthanized an animal that was in distress. Immediate had everyone worried that we were going to have to go to the barn every morning packing heat like Bruce Willis in Death Wish 3. And, you know, but all of a sudden, after a long time, without delay doesn't sound so bad. So we call less without delay. What were the biggest challenges? Ryder hit them on the head. In our sector, there's a lot of misperception in the industry that the code process was a government-driven process that got hijacked by extreme animal welfareists, and the mission was to defend, not participate. And on the other side of the coin, I think there is a perception out there that sometimes farmers aren't the sharpest tools in the tool shed, and they need to be guided by large, comprehensive management plans with standard operating procedures and all of that kind of thing. And of course, that makes sense for a large sheep farm with 4,000 or 5,000 head and 5 or 6 employees to have that, but it makes no sense for a small family flock of 100 head with one guy doing the work. I mean, is the standard operating procedure for that has to be updated every 2 or 3 months for euthanizing an animal going to say, go get the gun? The only way of overcoming those challenges is by talking, and that's talking in a respectful manner at the table, and that worked very well in our code group. So what are these codes going to do for our sector? We're extremely fortunate. The pork group and the chicken group drew are effective lightning rods for us. They take a lot of the heat, and we were able to follow in the slipstream. But the code is going to provide our sector with a good comprehensive guide for animal care and welfare. The appendices that we chose to include are going to be a very useful resource in one spot. People aren't going to have to search around various places for information. It's going to be in one place. And, it's my estimation that 85% of our sector will be unaffected by our current practices will be unaffected by the new code. We got the code right, and the sector wasn't too far off to start with. There are some, however, that are going to have to change, and particularly the section around veterinarian farm relationships, client relationships, is going to be a challenge in some areas of the country because there's a dearth of veterinarians in some areas that have a responsibility for small ruminants, and we're going to have to work through that with the vet crowd to figure out how to make that happen. And what is needed to maintain the commitment? It was interesting going through the process when we did initial consultations. Producer groups would say, or producers would say, they'd never heard about the codes, they'd never heard about any code, but they had a copy of the old code on their shelves and they referred to it. When you visited the farm, I worked a little bit as a field person for the Sheep Federation. When you'd do on-farm visits, you'd see by the way they were managing in the barn that they had looked at the code and they understood the code and they were following old code practices. And although they said they knew nothing about the code, they knew what the code was. Farmers, in my opinion, aren't going to download a PDF, 145-page PDF document from the web, try and put it in some sort of useful binding so that they can refer to it, and they're not going to refer to it online. They'll look at it online, but they're not going to use it that way. So I think to get ongoing commitment and buy-in, we need to find a way of distributing it in hard copy through provincial organizations, make bits and pieces of it available in provincial newsletters as ongoing education, and I think that will do the job for us. And the last thing that I learned through the process was that the whole process is possible because of the professionalism and dedication of the academic community, the scientific community, the welfare community, and the farmers sitting around the table. They listened to each other, were respectful, and lots of respectful, not respectable. Some of them aren't very respectable at all. But they listened to each other, and sure, there's lots of contention and points of view that differed, but in the end, we all realized that we were there for the same reason, and that is the welfare of the animals that are in our care. And as Tina said, I think that's something that Canada should be proud of, and everybody that was involved in the code processes should be proud of. So I guess with that, I'm finished.
I will come up here and direct questions, I know. I thought, though, you may have questions amongst yourselves for each other. Is there any? I saw you. No? Okay. Well, thank you. That was very.
I was just going to point out. I was just going to point out what I meant by policy wonk, and with the slides coming to meetings with organization charts with circles and arrows.
But it all works.
Thanks
so much. And we do have lots of time for questions. And who wants to open the questions up? Who's going to be first besides me? Well, then I have one. You have one here?
Yeah, I do.
Thank you.
Brian Chomlock with Alberta Beef Producers. Ryder, I was just wondering, I understand requirements and recommendations. And in the beef code, you put the recommendations and the requirements together. And most producers are scared that recommendations are going to become requirements the next draft. And I was wondering if why in the comment period we put in that we would like them in a separate appendix. And I was just wanting to know your thoughts.
Yeah, you were very clear on that. And I would thank the Canadian commenters to the codes of practice comment process, because we had hundreds of comments, and many of them were even useful. No, most of them were useful. But, there was some forceful, a lot of forceful comments in there. And you know, when you look at the final versus the draft, we did make changes, and there were some things that we overlooked that we laughed amongst ourselves that we had overlooked. But the reality is that's the form that Canada's codes of practice have taken. These are recommendations and requirements for good animal care. Why something is a requirement, there's a certain amount of barrier to be able to clear to become a requirement. It has to be applicable all the time. It has to be something that you can actively, assess or something. You know, it's harder to make a requirement than a recommended practice. The recommended practices were softer. We're not always able to apply or are always needed for good outcomes. So the fear of requirement or recommended practices becoming requirements is real. I referenced, some of the experiences that people are having around environment regulation and other things happening across the country, where the bar keeps moving, I guess, and that's a real concern of producers, and one I think we had ample conversation about, that it just wasn't going to happen. What we've tried to do, we changed the preface a little bit to clearly state what is a recommendation and what's a requirement and how we expect them to be used as committees, as NFAC. We also separated out the requirements in their own appendix so that it was clear that, hey, these are a different kettle of fish than those are. So, yeah, we didn't meet your recommendation, and the group was comfortable with that, but some of the other comments we did. And we can't say what any judge is or is not going to do, or any outfit is or is not going to do with this code of practice. They might use one little quote in completely the wrong way that we thought they would, and that might have happened with the existing code of practice. They might not even refer to a code of practice. They might use some other document as a reference. We don't know what's going to happen, but this is what this committee agreed is the requirements and recommendations for good cattle care in Canada.
Any others? I think there's a question back here, Fred, but do you have a comment?
Well, I was just going to add that I think there's a point there to be thought of as we try and maintain commitment, because I think in the production sector there is a real concern that there is going to be creep, regulatory creep, another creep, and that what is a recommended practice will be requirement tomorrow. So I think we need to make producers aware that as knowledge grows, there will be changes, that nothing is ever static, but allay the fear that just because something is a recommended practice now doesn't necessarily mean it will be a requirement later, or that it may not be a requirement. Just to give them the information and let them make their own minds, but don't let them live in fear that that's what's going to happen.
Thank you. There's a question over here.
Yes, Denis Frenette from the Quebec Ag Board. We're seeing the codes being developed at the moment. And we heard about people saying about the next phase would be to verify or audit, or is it being applied on the field? How do you see that going forward? Who should do it? And does anybody on the panel, did anybody take a look at this or reflected on this and see and have any proposition on how we should move forward with this?
Who would like to address that? Thanks, Jeff.
I think it's a great question, and I've sort of put that out there as a as an antecedent, I guess, for the rest of the conference. There's a lot of other content on the agenda for the next couple of days about assessment. I think there are industry associations that have a leg up on this because they've already designed some kind of assessment program, the associations that have done that, they do have a leg up because there's some infrastructure there already, particularly in the supply-managed commodities. I think each industry association is going to have to take whatever opportunities are available to make that happen in the most convenient way. Using existing infrastructure that's available for other kinds of assessment, for instance, food safety, and building on that without it becoming overly cumbersome to create a whole new system. So I think that's probably what we're beginning to see, for instance, with Dairy Farmers of Canada piling NFAC's animal care assessment framework and developing their program. But by the end of the conference, there might be a lot of other opinions and ideas about assessment.
Thank you. Anybody else on the panel wish to comment on that question? Fred? Ryder?
Well, I guess Jeff made the point, too, that we came forward to NFAC and requested to go through the code development process. The Canadian Cattlemen's Association board passed policy that we do that. Because NFAC develops a code development process, that doesn't mean anybody has to use it. Because we're working on an animal care assessment framework, which would be how you would maybe go about making that, doing that assessment, designing that assessment program, in fact, it's not going to be knocking on anybody's door saying, hey, we got this, you use it. It's going to be up to you and your reality of your industry that, you know what, we need to do this, and here's a good way to do it. Let's go through that process. It's industry taking leadership.
Questions? Anything else?
As the floor mic girl, am I allowed to ask a question?
Go ahead.
Just a question for Tina. You mentioned, of course, that a lot of work goes into writing the scientific reports, and they're very well used by the code development committees. Do you see those reports, which are published online, do you see them getting used in other contexts or for other purposes as a resource?
I think that people around the world will use them. They're online. I know that the scientists committee themselves used reports from other parts of the world. The European Food Safety Authority has their welfare committee reports in the journal and that. So I do think that they will be useful in other things as well. Yeah. Hopefully, I hope they will.
Scanning the room, then I have a question. Ryder, the hoodwinker, lifespan of the code, what would be ideal for you and why?
Well, that's something that we talk about around the National Farm Animal Care Council board. Less than 22 years, I guess, is a starting point. you know, we're talking about reviewing every 5 years and renewing every 10 years, and I think that's pretty solid from the standpoint of incremental change is easier to swallow than a whole lump. It also, by reviewing every every 5 years, it informs what we need to work on from the research side of things and helps us do that too. So the Beef Science Cluster was approved here or announced a little while ago, and we get that out the door and look into some of the animal care things that are being researched there. And in 5 years, if we're renewing the code and we're hopefully renewing the cluster as well, those things kind of collide well. What we'll have to do is balance the resources of the National Farm Animal Care Council. Doing 8 codes at a time, you heard it from Jackie and Edouard, you heard it from Tina, we don't really have, well, obviously we do, but it's not fair to try to do that over and over again, and largely without a bucket of cash from the federal government, we don't have the resources to do all of those at the same time. So 5, 6, 7 years, depending on how we stagger those out in the coming while to the next review, I think would be more than fair to keep it fresh. I don't think this conversation is going back under the blanket of the last 22 years. I think it's going to stay a little higher up than it was.
Thanks. Question over here.
Yeah, it's Casey Vanderplug with the National Cattle Feeders. Our organization is actually now involved in a process looking to develop a feedlot assessment tool that includes animal welfare components. And so one of the things that we're looking at is using the new beef code as kind of a starting platform for us to develop, you know, practices specific to the feedlot sector. So how would you view that kind of usage of the code as it's emerged? Is it a positive thing? Is it a thing that perhaps other industries can look at it to use it also as a tool to refine practices that are perhaps more specific to a certain aspect of production? Any one writer?
I mean, the first thing I'd say is our industry and the segmentation that we have and the diversity that we have is a little bit different. You know, we're not writing a code for each, where, you know, in the poultry industry there are some separate codes actually. So that's different. But, you know, I think I'd almost throw that to Jeff to see what his thoughts were. I think it's great if you're going to use it as a basis and use the pertinent parts. Then if you can get buy-in from all your stakeholders that you've got something that's worthwhile, I think that's kind of what we hoped that these things would be used for. Yeah, so go ahead, John.
Yeah, I think that's great if it can be useful that way. I think NFAC would like to see this. Anyone who's interested in developing a program, an assessment program based on the codes, use the new NFAC process to do that, just like dairy farmers have. Ultimately, there just needs to be. It makes perfect sense for a sector to start with the furthest downstream component. For instance, in the feedlot sector, it will just be easier to get to feedlots to do assessments than to every cow-calf operator across the countryside. So it's a totally reasonable place to start, and then there just needs to be transparency about what it means when you talk about that assessment program, that it does apply just to how to animal care and welfare on the feedlot, not necessarily back to any kind of assurance of how the cow-calf operator was conducting their business. I think that's the right way to proceed.
Other questions? Here we go, one more back here.
So,
you introduce yourself? Please?
Sorry, yeah, Guy Seguin, I work for Dairy Farmers of Canada. So, the topic was here scientifically informed, practical, and reflective of societal expectations. So, what would you say you wrote the code, so and then, you know, there's a certain line. So what do you suggest we do for non-compliance? It's an easy question.
Fred, do you want to start?
I don't think it makes any sense to try and write a general policy to cover all potential problems and end up with pablum that solves nothing. I think when there are problems, the problem should be dealt with, identified and dealt with. And it'll take some resolve by a few, but I think it can happen. In the sheep sector, there's going to be a small group that are involved in the show situation. They're going to be apoplectic when the code is released, and they're going to whinge and whine all over the place. But they can change if the code would be enforced, and enforced at shows. And it would only take one situation at the Royal Winter Fair where sheep were asked to leave because they were docked too short. Sheep are docked for a specific reason, a humane reason, to prevent fly strike and prevent a terrible death to probably 80% of the lamb crop from fly strike. But there is a length at which they should be docked for the welfare of the animal. All it would take was 1 year at the Royal Winter Fair in Toronto for improperly docked animals to be rejected from the show, and it would be resolved for next year. Who's going to do that? Not going to be me, but enforcement is what should do it. And bad actors need to be identified. Bad actors need to be dealt with. You can't write a glossy problem-solving thing for everything. You just need to identify the problems and resolve the problems one at a time.
Other comments?
I don't mean to be glib, but we should fix it. And the thing about the code is that it's all the way through the process, from selection of genetics to end of life. And some of those requirements not being met are a worse story than others. Some of those requirements, in ours at least, are regulatory requirements. So, you know, the agency will get involved if you're not meeting those. And their penalties are public and right there to understand and large. But some of these things are something that are probably only going to come up between you and your neighbor. And that's where industry ownership comes up. That's where farm animal councils come up, OFAC, or Farm and Food Care, AFAC, FACS, and the life of these codes. You know, it depends on what's being missed and what's the situation and what our correction can be. We need to own these things and make sure that we're getting there. Nobody's ever anywhere all the time to make sure that I'm doing a good job being a dad either, but I probably miss a few things there. You know, we need to fix it, we need to own it, and every industry will look different how they do that. But there's also a wide spectrum of things in these codes as well. And there are expectations that if you don't meet them, you're going to have a negative welfare outcome. And that'll point out to you yourself that maybe something needs to change.
Jeff, do you have any comments from your perspective with the Federation of Humane Societies?
I might punt this one to Kaylee Pugh from Saskatchewan SPCA to answer, since she's an enforcement agent herself.
And you saw me put my hand up because I had a question. I guess the question is, what do you do with the people that aren't complying? Is that what you're punting to me? Yeah? Well, in Saskatchewan anyway, the codes of practice... Do you want me to stand up to do this? Oh, my God. Okay. So in Saskatchewan anyway, the... NFAC codes of practice are all directly referenced in our Provincial Animal Protection Act, which means that they are essentially part of our legislation. So if we did have a complaint about a particular person doing something that was directly against the particular code of practice, it would be fairly easy from an enforcement agency perspective to take corrective action, whatever that happens to be. In Saskatchewan, the process is, you know, you work with a producer to point out whatever the problem is, and then if they don't correct it, they can face seizure of their animals, prosecution under various bits of legislation, etc. So from my perspective, the codes actually make that fairly easy if we get the complaint, right? So what I would like to see is if somebody comes up with these animal care assessment models and they, within their own commodity group, try really hard to rectify whatever the situation is, and they have that one outlier that they can't get compliant, then they would call an enforcement agency, whatever that happens to be, for their area. Does that answer the question?
Thank you very much.
No, I did kind of have a question, but I'm not sure I remember it now. Give me a sec.
Oh, yay, I'm not the only one. You think about it, I was just going to make a comment that we're seeing fairs and exhibitions taking stronger stands, particularly, you know, speaking from experience with the Calgary Stampede, but I'm sure you're going to see that with the codes getting out there. I'm thinking of horses, too, with docking.
I did remember
there
my question once I sat
see?
Down.
See how that works?
And it actually kind of ties in with what we were talking about. I guess it's more for Ryder and Fred specifically. Do your commodity organizations have any kind of strategy to get these codes out to all of the producers? And I'm not talking about the, you know, the top 25% of your producers that go to the meetings and read all the newspapers and that are already doing a really great job. What about that 5% that are the guys that I have to deal with that don't go to the meetings and don't read the newsletters? Is there some sort of strategy to get this information to those guys that really, really need to see it?
You know, that's a struggle, I guess. Our strategy right now is looking at expanding our on-farm food safety, our verified beef production program, to include things including environment and animal care and biosecurity, and that's probably you know, first going to go to those meeting types. It's not going to go to you know, the guy living on the edge of Ottawa who owns five bovine lawnmowers that don't really get the care and attention that somebody who depends on those ruminants for their living. And that's going to continue to be a struggle for us for probably forever. There's low barriers to entry to our business. If you own some grass and can find an auction yard, you can own cows. And you're probably not in on my Twitter feed or getting CCA's newsletters. So I can't say we fairly know how to do that. We struggle with, you know, Reynold Bergen, our science director, and I talk constantly over the years about how do we make people hear what we're saying, because some of the things that we're trying to make go away keep showing up. So it's not a problem that's easy to solve, and we'll continue to work on that.
Anybody else want to speak to that?
It is, as Ryder said, a struggle. And the sheep sector is probably the easiest commodity group, with the possible exception of goats, of getting in and getting out. Low investment in. You can have some pets. You can have 4 or 5 years, and then you can turn them over really easily if prices fall or something of that nature, or if you get sick of them or that kind of thing. And because they're cute and cuddly, a lot of people want to have a few in their backyards for the kids to play with, and don't really realize when they get into it that there is a greater responsibility there than just laying down your money and taking the animals home. The Ontario Sheep Marking Agency has a way of trying to reach those people and educating them, and I'm not just certain how that rolls out across the country. Some provincial organizations do have the resources to try and make that happen. Others don't. If they are just depending on volunteer donations and things of that nature for an association, they don't have the resources to get to those people. We tried, and the farmers actually agreed. One of the reasons the farmers agreed with the process of trying to build in some requirement in our code to have a management plan in place so that these types of people can be made to realize that they need to talk to somebody who knows what's going on and have an idea of what they're getting into before the 4 feet land on their ground. And it won't be easy. And some of these people could actually take the document out and read it to them, but they still wouldn't understand it and maybe not care because, as Ryder said, they're not in it because they're farmers. They're in it because they think it might be a kitschy thing to do for a while. And so it will be a struggle, and I don't know that we've got a perfect strategy for dealing with it, but I know it's on our radar.
Hi, Jorge Correa with the Economic Council. After the previous question, I was wondering if people here can respond if the code of practices are incorporated to the provincial legislation in all the provinces. Well, we see in Saskatchewan is that case. I'm wondering if in other provinces are the same.
Who would like to answer that? Ryder, Jeff?
Not in BC. But in BC, the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act makes reference to reasonable and generally accepted practices, and the codes are usually introduced as evidence if something ever got to the courts, and our constables use them educationally when responding to complaints. In other provinces, Alberta and Ontario, I don't think directly reference them, but may have a similar situation, but there may be somebody here from the ministries in those departments, in those provinces who could answer that better than I could. And Manitoba does have them outlined directly in the regulations. Atlantic Canada is a bit of a mishmash. Newfoundland definitely references them in their regulations. So it's kind of a shotgun across the country. They are used in some way or another by enforcement agencies in every province, though, even if it's just to serve as evidence of what constitutes a generally accepted practice, even without being directly referenced in the law.